So welcome to our little series on the mind and mental factors. We're going to go Tuesday, Thursday. Try to cover the subject to some degree. And rather than saying prayers at the beginning, so those of you who've come to some of the other of my talks know I prefer to do a little meditation at the beginning, sort of to calm our mind, get ready for the class, but also to set a virtuous motivation. So relax your body, sit with your spine erect. When Geshe Damdul, Dorje Damdul was here recently, he mentioned of the seven postures, it was very important to sit sort of straight. I think His Holiness has mentioned that helps the prana, the chi in our body to flow and we don't become sluggish and so forth. So relax your body, relax your mind, which of course is perhaps more difficult to do. I like to think it means remind yourself that you don't have to attend, think about other things right now. And then just initiate by watching, mentally watching your breathing without controlling it, recognizing when you're breathing in and when you're breathing out, and keep that awareness of the breathing even at the end points when it's changing direction, where there's a tendency as the winds are not moving, maybe kind of temptation to sort of pay attention to other things you've been thinking about. Let go of other thoughts. Just watch the breathing. Let go of attention to what your eyes might be seeing, even if your eyes are closed, the blackness, let go of that. Maybe just open your eyes a little bit to let some light in. Let go of what your ears are hearing or your body is feeling. If you notice you're still engaging in some attention to thoughts about the past or the future, or observing what's happening right now, other than the breathing, just let go of those and squeeze your attention. It doesn't mean squeezing your body. It's squeezing your attention, putting a little more tension into it to watch the breathing, the respiration. Hopefully you're having a little success with that, calming the mind. And follow one inhalation as though it's going in your nostrils, to the crown of your head, to your throat, to the center of your chest, near the back, or your so-called heart chakra. Leave your attention there. Let go of attending to the breathing. And just watch your mental consciousness, one part of your mind, your mental consciousness, watching the rest. Any objects of thought that arise are like, we could say, like birds in the sky, in the large empty space of sky, or like fish in an aquarium. Rather than focusing on the objective thoughts, put your attention on the mind that's perceiving them. By seeing the quiet mind between the thoughts, clear, knowing, and focusing on that, try to make that period between thoughts longer and longer. Even when the thoughts are present, if you're having difficulty letting go of them, use your wisdom to recognize that the fact that the thoughts are present means that the mind itself is non-obstructing. The thoughts can come, they can go. They're not trapped by the mind. The mind arises in the aspect of the object, you know, in an image of the object, whatever presents itself to the mind, in the same way that a mirror, without any effort, reflects an object. What we're trying to observe, we're trying to get a mental image of, is the conventional, clear light nature of the mind, unobstructing, illuminating, reflective, and having the capacity to know or experience, to cognize. Can be referred to as the conventional Buddha nature. When we talk about Buddha nature, usually we mean the emptiness of this mind, the emptiness of this mind. But here we're looking on the conventional level. We're trying to get an understanding of the ability of the mind to develop the qualities that it has not yet developed, like bodhicitta, renunciation, wisdom of emptiness, and to let go of, to eliminate, to cease negative states of mind. This precious opportunity I've encountered right now due to actions in past lives. Somehow I've practiced ethics and other virtuous actions in the past that has led, perhaps after a long period of time, to a human rebirth, encountering the Dharma, having the fortune to look at this clear light nature of the mind and be inspired to follow the path taught by the Buddha, his Dharma, his teachings, and to rely upon the Sangha, and its conventional, and its conventional meaning, just the a congregation of monks and nuns that help us take ordination, help us take the medicine of the Dharma, up until the higher beings that have realized emptiness, the Arya Sangha, whether they're ordained or not. And think that during this series of talks, I'm going to try to use this opportunity to heal myself, in the sense of the medicine Buddha, not just immediate healing, like giving some medicine to alleviate some immediate disease, although that can happen, but mainly to heal ourselves in some fundamental way, to overcome our anger, our attachment, our laziness, our low self-esteem, our jealousy, our pride. And in so doing, to make ourselves a fit receptacle to then to develop and enhance the positive qualities like altruism and compassion, love for others. Make a determination, like a motivation. This is why I'm going to be participating in the course, to become less harmful to others and then to become beneficial for them. Well, just even becoming less harmful is beneficial for them, but to develop positive states of mind, to practice the Bodhisattva deeds, living beings, whether we recall it or not now, have been our mother. Not once, numberless times in the past. We just don't recognize that. Feeling some closeness to them. Responsibility to alleviate their suffering. Because they, exactly as we do, want to be free of suffering, want to experience happiness. See if you can motivate with a semblance of a bodhicitta motivation. I'm going to participate, listen, contemplate, meditate in order to achieve enlightenment for the sake of all mother sentient beings. And then relax, bring your attention back to the present. when I've asked you before if there are any observations, no one has ever ventured any, but maybe tonight there's some new people. Anyone have any questions or observations about their meditation? So, we're going to be talking about the mind and mental factors, citta and cetana, or chaita, sorry, not cetana, chaita, citta and chaita. I can't remember where I misspoke. I said this many times, cetana, and I'm seeing it right in front of me. It's mental factors are called chaita. In Tibetan, sem. And the chaita, the mental factors, are called semjung. Jung means to arise. So it's kind of like sem or citta means just the fundamental nature of our mind, our primary consciousnesses, not just our mental, also our eye, ear, nose, tongue, and touch consciousnesses. That fundamental entity of the consciousness that perceives the mere perceptual field without making any distinctions. That's called primary consciousness. You know, in the five aggregates, which one of the aggregates is the primary consciousness? Those of you who know what I'm talking about when I talk about the five aggregates. Is it feeling? Is that the primary consciousness? No. Discrimination? No. Compositional factors? No. Form? No. It's the last one. When the last aggregate that is called the consciousness aggregate, it actually refers to primary consciousness, not any of the other mental factors, right? So we have six primary consciousnesses. Primary consciousness of the five senses, and the sixth consciousness, the mental consciousness. I was joking, one of the earlier class, there was a movie some years ago called The Sixth Sense. It was almost like in common nomenclature in the world, people think there's something mystical. But they don't think so much that we have a... that the consciousness, the mental consciousness, is the sixth sense. This, I think in that movie it was talking about some ability to know ghosts or something like that. But here, the sixth sense. By the way, we say there are five aggregates, right? You know the five aggregates I'm talking about, right? This gentleman. You know or no? You don't know that I'm pointing to you, or maybe, yeah. Okay. So the five aggregates. So of the five aggregates, the first one is material form. The other four are all various kinds of consciousness, because the general word consciousness can mean mind, the primary consciousness, or the chaita, the mental factors that are simultaneous with the mind. So two of them are centered out, feeling and discrimination. And the fourth aggregate, compositional factors, includes all the other chaita. The fifth one is the primary consciousness. So why are feeling and discrimination, they are also chaita, right? They're mental factors. Why did the Buddha, when he talked about the five aggregates, why did he put them as a separate category? Why didn't he just say there were three skandhas? Form, all the chaita, and primary consciousness. You could say that, there's three. And then in the five aggregates, you divide the chaita into feeling, discrimination, and all the rest. So somehow they're given some preferential treatment. How come? Anyone know? You must have heard somewhere. Do you know? No. Jan, do you know? Do you know why feeling and discrimination are separate? You know, but you're afraid. You're too far back to say. Okay, Sweet Kim, do you know? We identify a lot more with feeling and discrimination.
We identify a lot with feeling and discrimination as compared to the rest of the mental factors. For example, you say, I feel this, I feel that, you know. And that feeling seems to be you.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. But also, if you feel dumb, you know, you kind of identify with your ignorance, you know. I forgot, you know. If you feel smart, you identify with your wisdom. I don't know. So that's good. Use some analysis to figure that out. It actually, in the Abhidharma Kosha, remember in one of the other classes we were talking about famous text, the Abhidharma Kosha by Vasubandhu. Vasubandhu mentioned, you know, he asks that question and answers it. He says that the Buddha, or maybe he, I'm not sure if he said the Buddha said or if it's some of these great scholars of the past said, the reason that feeling and discrimination are treated separately is that they are the ways that ordinary people and scholars involve themselves with cyclic existence. So the other day when we were talking about feeling, we were talking about how feeling can give rise, pleasant feeling gives rise to what? Craving, attachment, right? You want to have it. You want to have the object of your attachment or that pleasant feeling close to you, like say within your ego sphere. Unpleasant feelings give rise to a sense of repulsion, wanting to have and all of the things that are associated with anger and repulsion, anger, hatred, spite, and sometimes striking out. You want to have things outside of your ego sphere, so to speak. And neutral feelings lead to just a continuity of ignorance. So that's how ordinary people, that's what most people in the world are living for. Pleasant feelings, right? You want to have good food, and you want to have pleasant looking companions, or you want to hear sweet words that don't, you know, not criticism, you like to hear some pleasing words like I love you, or, you know, not criticism. Maybe praise, even fame to some extent. The scholars, the people who hold tenets, we were talking on the weekends on the four schools of Buddhist tenets. The scholars who hold various tenets, they engage in samsara. The main way they engage in samsara is discriminating, using discrimination. This tenet is good because of this. This your tenet is bad because this, and so forth. So this was an explanation in Abhidharma Kosha. Maybe something like that. But there's also other reasons when you talk about the Tantra and other higher subjects why these two might have been treated differently than the others. But that's a pretty good start. So if we start with a general category of consciousness that includes all of the mental activity, two divisions into citta and chaita, semjung, mind and mental factors we can call. So, mind, or citta, is a knower of the mere entity of an object, whereas mental factors are knowers which, on the basis of observing that object, so the primary consciousness, let's say the eye consciousness, is knowing the bare entity of the perceptual field, which would be what? What does the eye consciousness know? Do you remember? Shapes and colors, generally. You might say, oh, you hadn't heard, maybe you hadn't been to some of the other talks, you might say, well, it knows apples and oranges, and I know my daughter and my son, or my husband, my wife, whatever. But those discriminations are made by the mental consciousness. If some orange round shape is a fruit called orange, or some red slightly different shape is called an apple, that's done by the mental consciousness. The visual consciousness merely knows shapes and colors. So the primary visual consciousness would just be aware of this field of shapes and colors. The mental factors accompanying that primary consciousness are going to be able to discriminate within it. There's a mental factor of feeling, and we'll talk about them later, and discrimination and so forth. So what's the relationship between mind and mental factors? The spiritual program committee chose for this course, I wasn't clever enough to come up with that name. They said, what if mind is principle, who are its accomplices, or something like that? What? Oh, if mind is chief, who are its accomplices, like the chief? So what does that mean? So the primary consciousness and the mental factors are not findable in different places. It's not as though you could isolate the primary consciousness, and let's use the eye consciousness as an example, and then that the mental factors, the chitta within it, are, you know, something outside that. They are all present in the same consciousness within the entity of, let's say, eye consciousness. There is the primary eye consciousness that knows the bare perceptual field, and within that consciousness, the ability to discriminate aspects of it and so forth are called the mental factors. There's some monks at the door. I'm not sure if they want to just see the statue. I don't think they want to come to the class. Yeah, maybe they just want. Yeah. Oh, they're just observing. So a little bit like this, the example that's given sometime is that in the ancient world, a king and his retinue, you know, his ministers and queens, and I don't know what else, court jester, all the things that might be in the retinue of the king. You know what that means, retinue? Is that a word that's familiar? What's another word for that, retinue? Entourage, do you know the word entourage? If Madonna comes on the stage, or what was it the other night at the National Stadium, BTI or something like that? Some Korean, I heard there was some Korean group, 55,000 people came. So that maybe the group comes, but there's always the certain people that come along with them, the crew, the people who set up the microphones. They can't perform without their entourage, their retinue, their group. So like that, they say the primary consciousness is like the king or chief, as the title of the course is saying. If mind is chief, it means the primary consciousness is chief. Who are its accomplices, or those who accompany it? And so the mental factors are not separate from the primary consciousness. They're of the same within that consciousness, you can't separate one from the other. So some of the lamas say that this definition, there's two kinds of definitions of the relationship, two ways to explain this relationship between the primary consciousness and the mental factors. One is to say that the primary mind knows the mere entity of the perceptual field, and the mental factors are that which know the individual aspects of it, that engage in the individual aspects. That is said to be that's said to be a definition suitable for meditators. This is something you kind of experiential. There's another definition that's said to be suitable for debate, you know, to hold up, because the first definition, a little bit difficult to debate about. So we talk about mind and the mental factors, or a particular mind and its mental factors. Not just any mind and someone else's mental factors, but the eye consciousness and its mental factors. They have five things in common. We call five similarities. Have you heard that? What did they call in the basic program? What did they call? Five similarities, or Sungden Nga, bearing five similarities. So they have the same basis, a primary mind and its accompanying mental factors. They have the same basis in that they depend upon the same sense power. So what does that mean? So those of you who heard the previous course know a little bit, but we say that each of the consciousnesses, our five sense consciousnesses and our mental consciousness, have their own, in the case of the five senses, they all have a physical basis. Consciousness has to be present to have to know something, let's say to see something. Eye consciousness has to be present. There has to be an object of sight, and there also has to be an interface between the consciousness and the object. The consciousness doesn't just pop up and go out to the object. You know, in our Western world, we know that the eye has in the back, in the retina. Mine's losing its powers a little bit. I'm understanding from the doctors. In the retina, there are certain receptors we call rods and cones. Right? You study? Did you know? Rods and cones. Okay, I'm not sure. It's okay. That's Western, the Western terms. So they are receptors. They think they are the actual things that are going to transmit the image of the object that is refracted through your lens of your eye. Right? You know, there's a lens, and an image is. If you were to actually look at the eye, you would see an inverted image of what you're looking at on your retina, right? Do you know that? Okay. So in that retina, there are some little receptors, Western science has called rods and cones, that are subtle, very particular kind of matter. From a Buddhist perspective, within those rods and cones, there's even a more subtle kind of matter that we call the eye faculty, or the eye sense power. It is that which, within which the eye consciousness comes and resides. And when an object makes contact with that, in this case it's the inverted image, let's say, of the thing you're looking at, like an orange or a person, is when I say refracted, that means goes through your lens, is sort of projected on the back of your eye. When those three come together, we have the what's called the immediate condition, the eye consciousness. We have the object condition, observed object condition, which is the object. And we have the dominant condition, that which brings about the combination of that eye consciousness, seeing the object, that's the sense power. So each and any consciousness, any primary consciousness and its accompanying mental factors will have the same sense base, the same sense power, the same sense faculty. So that's said, that's the first of these five similarities. You won't have an eye consciousness. Well, let's give an example. Tongue consciousness. Okay? Tongue consciousness. You will not have a physical, you will not have a feeling of within your touch. You know, if you feel something that's smooth or something that's coarse with your sense, with your tactile sensation, right? You won't have those mental factors within your tongue consciousness. Your tongue consciousness has its own particular retinue, and they share that same faculty, the tongue faculty, okay? So then the mind and mental factors of the primary consciousness and mental factors are said to have the same object of observation. A mind and its mental factors observe the same object. For instance, when the main eye consciousness apprehends blue, you know, I'm not say the blue cushions or the blue, some of these little rubber things are blue. If the main consciousness that's not making discriminations but experiences that, the mental factors within that also observe that same object. For instance, when the main eye consciousness apprehends blue, so does the mental factor of feeling that accompanies that eye consciousness. So eye consciousness has certain mental factors within it. Always has five mental factors. We'll mention that in a second. A third similarity is that the mind, the primary mind and its mental factors bear the same aspect. So almost sounds like the same thing. Generally, though, you can have a slightly different thing. You can talk about the observed object as being, a person, and the aspect. I'm not talking about the visual consciousness, let's say, just talking about how you think about something. For instance, the main object might be a person, and the aspect within which you're understanding that person is male or female, some particular aspect of that, how that's presenting itself to your consciousness. So they have another factor of similarity. The mind, primary mind, and its mental factors have the same duration, or they have the same time. It's not as though a primary consciousness will be existing at one time and the mental factors that accompany it and that are perceiving the details of that main consciousness, that they would be at some different time, you know, 5 minutes later or something like that. So sameness of time, similarity of time. And then the fifth one is called sameness or similarity of substance. Just as at any one time the substantial entity of a particular mind, means this kind of like just the, if you think of mind as being a substance, it's not a substance in the sense of material, but it has in a certain sense kind of a substantial entity, you can find it somehow, localize it. Just as at any one time, the substantial entity of a particular mind is single. We don't have multiple eye consciousnesses. Well, you might say, well, wait a second, you have a right eye and left eye, but they are when your brain merges those two signals, right? You have just one visual consciousness. You have one auditory consciousness. You have one olfactory consciousness. You have one gustatory consciousness, and so forth. There are not many minds of the same type, such as several eye consciousnesses. So the substantial entity of, for instance, the mental factor of intention that accompanies the eye consciousness is also single. You just have, as you have one eye consciousness, each of the mental factors that accompany it also are just singular. So you might say, wow, that sounds pretty complicated. So that's, when we give a definition of the difference between primary mind and secondary mind, or mind and mental factors, the definition I gave you first maybe is more tasty, sort of like primary mind is that which knows the bare perceptual field. The mental factors are those that know the particular aspects of it, you know, individual experiences of it. But this definition, that mind and mental factors are those that bear these five similarities, is something that will hold under logical analysis. Okay. I'm reading from a list in Jeffrey Hopkins' book on the meditation on emptiness. So Jeffrey mentions that in this presentation of these five similarities, that's general presentation that we hear, but there are two main texts on the Abhidharma. And some of you who are new, you might be confused by some of this terminology, but some of you have been here and know what I mean. One was a text we talked about several times, the Abhidharma Kosha. Remember who wrote the Abhidharma Kosha? Vasubandhu, right? And there was another so that's mainly talking about the Hinayana tenets, mainly talking about the Vaibhashika tenets from the point of view of the Sautrantika. Okay, don't worry. The other famous Abhidharma text, do you know the other famous one? Swinkin? Abhidharma Samuchaya. And it was written by Vasubandhu's brother, Asanga, who was the Mahayanist from the beginning, who Vasubandhu was kind of critical of at the beginning, and said, oh, my brother follows that false Mahayana. So in Asanga's Abhidharma Samuchaya, so it's also talking about Abhidharma, but from the Mahayana point of view, he makes the list a little bit different. Same five, it is still number is five, but he conflates or puts together the same object of observation and the same aspect, similar aspect, in one. And he adds one in the place, because before you had two, and if you condense them into one, you'll only have four factors of similarity. So he adds one, sameness of realm and level. Sameness or similarity of realm and level. So what that means, say for instance, if you have an eye consciousness of the desire realm, that's the realm that we inhabit here as humans, is what animals inhabit, what the hungry ghosts inhabit, the hell beings inhabit, and the gods that we talk about in, you know, that supposedly Indra, the ones that you can sort of, you hear about generally. They're all in the desire realm. Well, there's one that you hear about regularly that's in the form realm, Brahma, but that's, leave Brahma aside. So if you have an eye consciousness of the desire realm, it's not going to have mental factors of the form realm or the formless realm. Or if you have, let's say you have a mental, because you've developed single point of concentration, you have a mental consciousness of the form realm. Remember we talked a little bit about this? If you develop shine, tranquil abiding, calm abiding, very deep kind of concentration. Not just like in a snap. There's a certain procedure to develop that. When you develop that, what's called shamatha, calm abiding, your mental consciousness is no longer an ordinary consciousness of the desire realm. I mean, you're in meditation, so you're not, your eyes are not open, you're not thinking, you're not having ordinary interaction with the world. Your mind is actually elevated, in a sense, from the desire realm, and you have a form realm, mind of the form realm, that level. So the mental factors in that mental consciousness will be now mental factors of the form realm. You won't have a feeling in the mental consciousness of the desire realm while that form realm consciousness is present. The discriminations will be discriminations of the form realm and so forth. So that's the slight difference that he made. Okay, so that's technical. Maybe you're not so interested in that. Some of you are, maybe some of you aren't. So there are six kinds of consciousness, generally, we accept. Is that right? Six kinds? Don't the Chittamatras accept eight? But that's different. That's a little more subtle. We'll talk about that a little bit later. Usually we say there are six consciousnesses. And as we were saying before, the usual five, the eye consciousness, ear, nose, taste, touch, tactile consciousness, and the mental consciousness. There's no other kind of consciousness that can't be put in one of those categories, although you sometimes see lists that are longer. An eye consciousness is a particular knower that depends on the eye. Depending on the eye, a knower that depends on the eye, that means the eye faculty, and it observes visual form. So visual forms are said not to be apples and oranges and fences and houses. Visual forms are said to be shapes and colors. That's what consciousness, eye consciousness, actually perceives. Although you could say, well, it is perceiving persons that have these maybe different colors on a different color shirt and pants or skirt or hair or whatever. But the domain of eye consciousness is shapes and colors, for instance. An ear consciousness is an individual knower depending on the ear faculty, which again means some subtle matter within the... There's some little... what do they usually say in Western science? There's some thing shaped like a shell within our ear, right? Within that there's a fluid, and then within that fluid there's some little filaments that actually can notice when the... when pressure, when you hear sounds, the fluid within that little canal is compressed or decompressed as the waves, the sound waves come, and those little filaments of sense, ear receptors, I'm not sure what they're called. Do you know what they're called in Western medicine or science? They perceive that. So Buddhism would say that within those things you can actually see with a microscope, there's something more subtle that we call the ear sense power. So it acts as the interface between the ear consciousness that comes up, resides there, and the object that impinges upon them, which is what we call sound. A nose consciousness is an individual knower depending on the nose and observing odor. So here again, it doesn't mean the gross nose. This is not... I remember when I I attended a conference in Dharamsala many, many years ago that the Jewish rabbis had come to hold a conference with the Dalai Lama. They wanted to share common experiences about cultures that had been expelled from their native lands. You know, like the Jewish people believe they've been living in, how do you pronounce it, Diaspora? Is that the correct pronunciation? Like, pardon? Diaspora? Diaspora. Oh. Oh, I thought it started with D. Okay. I'll check. Maybe in Hebrew it's pronounced differently. I'm not sure. So they had come, and I had a chance to attend one lunch with some of the rabbis just for fun. And they thought I was Jewish because my name is Chernoff. It's a Russian name, but they thought, yeah, he must be Jewish. Chernoff, he's got to be Jewish. And his big nose, you know. You know, a lot of Jewish people have big noses. Not all. There's some, you know. So when we talk about the nose sense power, we don't mean this big piece of flesh. We're talking about receptors. Just as in the eye, when we talk about the eye faculty, we don't mean the eyeball or the fluid within it or even the retina. We're talking about some subtle matter within the rods and cones of the retina. Also the nose, there's certain receptors that can perceive the various kinds of odor. A tongue consciousness is an individual knower, depending on the tongue sense, and that observes taste. A body consciousness is an individual knower that depends on the body consciousness and observes tangible objects. So what kind of tangible objects does the body sense perceive? Do you know? It's said to be able to know soft and rough. What else? What's another object that we know with our sense, our body consciousness? Hot and cold. Yeah. So you might wonder, you know, so we can sense when it's hot or when something is hot. We know that through the sense power. Sometimes if you put, my dad used to say, if you just wanted to see if something was hot very carefully, you would approach it to your eye. It wasn't that the eye consciousness is perceiving that something is hot, but the body sense consciousness that pervades the whole of our skin and most of our body also is present in our eye. Maybe it's more sensitive there. I don't know why. The tactile consciousness also experiences different things like that. So what kind of consciousness realizes or knows emptiness? Remember, in Buddhism, this very crucial understanding that means not just that the room is empty or something like that, that recognizes, for instance, that the sense of self that seems so real and palpable there doesn't exist the way that it appears, that that appearance is empty of existing the way that it appears. Which consciousness realizes that? I sense? Mental consciousness, right? You don't realize emptiness with your sense consciousness. Although, in the case of a Buddha can realize emptiness with any of his senses. It's just like his, you know, his Superman, right? So there's the story that the lamas like to tell when we studied these subjects. There was some Tibetan Geshe whose eyes were getting worse and worse. And you know the Tibetan texts that they used at the monasteries, usually they were written in quite large letters for that purpose, because they didn't have, in past days, they didn't have access to glasses when your eyes started getting weaker. So the letters were all quite big. Not like the small notes on your cell phone or something like that. You know, I can't read sometime without glasses. So this lama, he was a teacher, but maybe he was a tulku. I think he was a tulku that, you know, some people thought maybe he's actually Buddha, you know, actually emanated as a guru teaching. So as his eyes got more and more degenerated, he would just run his hand over the page. Now generally, you might say it was kind of like Braille, that he could read like that. No. You can't sense the difference of the you know, the texture between the black ink and the paper on these texts. That's not how, it said that the implication was that when his eyes got bad, he would just sort of like, he'd read the text like this. Like a Buddha, his sense consciousness was cognizing the visual object, you know, his tactile consciousness. So just this little, you may hear that story sometime. So Buddha's consciousnesses are cross-functional. The mental consciousness that realizes emptiness has the capacity to penetrate first conceptually and then non-conceptually. We talked a little bit about that before. Mental consciousness, generally what we experience in our mental consciousness now are thoughts, right? You know, opinions, judgments, you know, oh, this is terrible, you know, or this is great, or who is that person talking to? You know, all sorts of thoughts come into our mind. All of these are within the realm of what we call conceptual or thought processes. That function of our mental consciousness is different than our other senses. Our other senses know things through a process of what we call bare perception or direct perception. There's no image involved. It knows the object that is. It is, let's say, the eye consciousness is seeing shapes and colors and directly. Whereas the mental consciousness, if you think about your mother's face is not the main thing is appearing to your mental consciousness. Even if your mother is somewhere else, miles away, you can think about your mother's face, right? Can you see your mother's face if she's many miles away? Skype? FaceTime? Video conference? Oh no, you're not seeing her face. You're seeing an image of her face. You might say that if you had a photograph of her, that's not exactly the same as seeing her face, right? In real life. So generally the bare perception knows its objects without any kind of anything in between it and the object. Whereas the mental consciousness in conception knows its objects via some image that's appearing to the mind, an image of your mother's face. You're not actually focusing on that image. It's as though you're looking through that image and you're knowing your mother's face as a result of that. So that mental image is called the appearing object of the consciousness, of the conception. Mental consciousness has the capacity to penetrate first conceptually by a mental image and then non-conceptually. That is, it can know directly. That mental image can disappear and it can act in a way that it knows the nature of phenomena, the ultimate nature of phenomena, emptiness, directly. That's what we believe. Remember in the Sautrantika school, they say mental direct perception, yogic direct perception, doesn't perceive emptiness directly. Remember, how does it know emptiness? This is just talking to those people that had done that in the class. It knows the impermanence of the aggregates and knows the emptiness indirectly. Just like you know, if you see a vase that is just you just bought from the store, you look at it and you would, although you don't see flowers there, you know that there are no flowers. The fact that you see the empty vase, you know indirectly that there are no flowers there. It's not that no flowers are appearing, that some substantial thing called no flower is appearing to your eye consciousness. You could say that no flowers are appearing, and therefore you realize that your mental consciousness knows that something called non-flower exists there. Like in this room, I gave the example before. You don't see an elephant right now, although and the non-existence of elephant is something which is an intellectual construct. So you know that indirectly. You see the room, you don't see elephant, and indirectly you're knowing the entity of non-elephant. Okay, subtle point, doesn't matter as much. Okay, so beyond the bare perceptions, we're talking about mental factors, these chaita. How many mental factors are there? You have any idea? Did you say 52? No. You have to remember, how many weeks are there in a year? 52. It's not 52. Mental factors. That's how I can remember, you know. It's 51 mental factors. But even then, there are many more mental factors than that. These are the main, you know, when the Buddha explained, these are the main ones. So don't make that mistake on your test. Now you know something to remember. If the question comes on the basic program, how many mental factors? Not 52. If you could write that down, maybe you get partial credit. But you didn't say, don't say 53. It's 51 mental factors, okay? This particular list of mental factors, is that found in the Abhidharma Kosha? Remember these two Abhidharmas, one by Vasubandhu and one by his brother Asanga. 51 mental factors comes in. Do you know, Mabel? Jan, do you know? You probably remember from the old days. Huh? The list in Abhidharma Kosha is different. I think there's sometimes talk about 48 and other numbers of mental factors. Also in the Theravada, when you study Abhidharma, there's all sorts of lists of mental factors, different numbers, never. But the list of 51 comes from Asanga's Abhidharma Samuchaya. It's from the Mahayana Sutras, not just his own invention. So of these, there are a couple of groups, a few groups here. So there's a group called the omnipresent mental factors. Omnipresent. Do you know what omnipresent means? Always present. Whenever it doesn't mean when you're asleep that the omnipresent mental factors will be present in your eye consciousness. Only when the primary consciousness is present, and that can only be activated when you have those three basic conditions. You have the consciousness present, that's called the immediate condition, and you have an object condition, so let's say in the case of eye consciousness, shape and color, that is refracted on the back of your eye, and you have the dominant condition, the sense power. Those three conditions have to be present to generate an eye consciousness. If when you get drowsy or when you're going to sleep, your eye consciousness recedes away from the eye faculty, so it's not capable then of seeing. So there won't be any, as there's no eye consciousness at that time, there won't be any omnipresent mental factors, right? You don't have omnipresent, even though the word is omnipresent, they're only present when the consciousness is, they're always present when the consciousness is there, they're not present when the consciousness is not there. So how many omnipresent mental factors are there, those of you who've studied before? Yeah. Do you know? Five omnipresent mental factors. So then there is another group, and we'll go over what those are. There's another group called variously, different names that are given. People argue about how you should translate the name. I like to call them object ascertaining factors. They are, or Jeffrey translates them here as determining factors. There are five of these also. Object ascertaining factors. How did they translate in your basic program syllabus curriculum? Same? Which? Object ascertaining? Yeah. So these are present in primary consciousnesses that know their objects. If the consciousness is knowing an object, besides the omnipresent mental factors, these object ascertaining factors will also be present. Oh, they're also present in the mental consciousness. So there are 10, there are 5 omnipresent and 5 object ascertaining. So that leaves how many more? 41, right? Those 10 object, those 10 omnipresent mental factors, object ascertaining mental factors, 5 and 5, they are present in sense consciousnesses. None of the other 41 mental factors, is that right? None of the other mental, none of the other 51 mental factors are present in the sense consciousnesses? Is that right? What about the changeable mental factor of sleep? No, we'll talk about that later. Anyway, something to think about. Generally, the other mental factors. So we've got 10 so far. 5 omnipresent, 5 object ascertaining, which are all present in the senses and also the mental consciousness, primary consciousness. Then we talk about the virtuous mental factors. How many virtuous mental factors are there? 11, right? Of course, there are many, many millions of virtuous states of mind. So when we say 11 virtuous mental factors, we're talking about some principal ones that the Buddha explained that were particularly important. And so when we go through those, that's very interesting because those are the ones that we want to enhance if we have them, or if they come as a surprise to us, like, oh, virtuous, I didn't even know that was virtuous. Maybe I never generate that mind. You want to either enhance that factor that you have. Okay, how about wisdom? Is that a virtuous mental factor, right? Sharab prajna, is that a virtuous mental factor? You would think so, right? You'd usually think that's, but you can use wisdom to make bombs, to, you know, some poison or something like that. You can use your wisdom to cheat others. Wisdom is actually one of the, what? 5 object ascertaining factors. When you know an object, there's a certain factor of understanding that we call wisdom. So we'll talk about what the virtuous mental factors are. 11 virtuous mental factors. So what does that make? 10 and 11 make 21, right? So we've got 30 more to go. So then there's the negative side. There are what are called the 6 root klesha, 6 root delusions. Are they present in our eyes? No. Are the virtuous mental factors present in our eye consciousness, our ear consciousness? No. They're only present in the mental consciousness. So you might think, you see a child, you have sympathy in your eyes, you might see someone else who feels sympathy and their eyes are tearing up and big, and it's as though their eye has compassion. There's no the mental factor compassion is not present in the eye consciousness. The eye provides some information to the mental consciousness that then makes that, you know, some judgment about something. I saw something on the news the other day, the CNN, you know, on the internet, you can look at the cable news network, they used to call. some people were fellows were driving a van that the police recognized had been stolen, so the police stopped them and they asked the fellows to get out. They did. They followed the directions. They put their hands in the air. And the police didn't realize that there was a little child inside the van. I can't remember. Anyone read that article? I think it was very young, 2 or 3 or 4 years old. And the little child got out barefoot. The police didn't realize the child. And also with his hands in the air, walking toward the police, following his father or her father. And I can imagine people who saw that, tears would be coming, compassion would be welling. But that's not, the compassion is not rising in the eye consciousness, rising in the mental consciousness. And the tears, even though they're coming from the eye, it's not that the eye consciousness had that compassion. The tears happen to be an artifact of developing that, in the case of compassion or sorrow or something like that. There are other kinds of other things. So there are 6 root afflictions. Do you know what they are? We talked the other day. Do you know what the 6 root afflictions are? No? Do you know? No? Oh, okay. That's the easy way to get out of it. Okay. Do you know the 6 root? Neither of you do. Okay. You thought, you were assuming I was pointing to her, and she assumed I was pointing to you. Okay. Do you know the 6 root delusions? No? You know some? Which? What is what? Do you know the 6 root delusions or 6 root afflictions? This afflictions, yeah. Yeah, okay, one is anger. That's good start. What? Ignorance is one. See, you did know some, okay. You did putting yourself down. And then what wants to have things? Let's see. Generous? Oh, jealous. Is jealousy one of the 6 root delusions? Often people think that. It's not one of the... Sometimes in Tantra that comes in when we talk about the 5 skandhas, something like that. But so we'll start. Ignorance and attachment. That's it. Even though we often think attachment is good, it's actually an affliction. Anger. Pride. What? Greed. G-R-E-E-D. That would fall under attachment. One of the variations of attachment. So pride is one of them. And then doubt, what's called afflicted doubt. Remember when some of you who were for the course for Lohrig, when we talked about the ways of knowing, one of them was called doubt or indecisive wavering. What else do they have? All these different names. But doubt. So there's a kind of doubt which is not this afflicted doubt. Like the doubt thinks, maybe there were past lives and future lives, maybe not, but there probably are. It's still not completely decided there are, that karma exists or that reincarnation exists, but is leaning in that direction. That kind of doubt is not this afflicted doubt. So we have ignorance, attachment, anger, pride. There are various kinds, divisions of pride. Doubt, afflicted doubt. And what's the 6th one? Afflicted view, right? Wrong view. Wrong view? Well, usually we say view. The reason is, if you divide view up, that 6th one, you can divide into 5. So there's all, really there's 10 altogether. 10, we say 10 afflicted views and non-views. The non-views are these 5 we just mentioned. Ignorance, attachment, anger, doubt, a pride and doubt, right? And the 5 views, one of them is called wrong view. All of these views are afflicted. They cause disturbance to the mind. They're mental mental experiences. Okay, so there are six root afflictions, but if you were to divide them up, you would say there are 10, because you have to use your fingers to remember that, because you say six, and then the sixth one is divided into five. So the one disappears, arises as five, so there's 10 altogether. They call 10 afflicted views and non-views. Then there are secondary afflictions. Secondary afflictions, or how else do they translate it? I guess the secondary afflictions. Do you have another translation? It means not the primary ones, but things that are coming out of them. How many are there? 20, right? 20 secondary afflictions. So the afflictions are called, the root afflictions are called mula klesha. You know what mula means? Mula means root. Root afflictions. So in has anyone been to Bodh Gaya? You've been to Bodh Gaya? So one of the great disciples of Lama Zopa, Kabir Saxena, his mother was English, you know, Caucasian. His father was Indian. I say was. I think his father's maybe still alive. I should say his father's is Indian. And so Kabir had, you know, was educated at Oxford, or I think it was Oxford. Anyway, he went back to India and he helped start Root Institute and put all of the things there. So he was well known because he looked Indian. You know, he had dark complexion from his father, looked Indian. And so when the rickshaw drivers saw him and they knew that he was from Root Institute, they said, where do you want to go? Mula? What does mula mean? Root. So they called Root Institute Mula, the rickshaw drivers. They knew that it was called Mula. So Mula is just one L, right? M-U-L-A. Mula Klesha, the root afflictions. And the secondary afflictions, the 20, are called the Upa Klesha. The Upa Klesha. So that involves variations of subtlety, things that are not as common as the six root afflictions. So that brings us up to 57. And then the last of the divisions are what are called the changeable mental factors that can change from one thing to another. So we'll talk about those in time. So first of all, the omnipresent mental factors, they're so named because they necessarily accompany all minds, even the wisdom realizing emptiness. You should know that. Even when you have a mental consciousness realizing emptiness, there's still going to be these five omnipresent mental factors. So they are... there's different orders you can say them, but it was some particular reason for saying here. Feeling. Remember, we've talked a lot about feeling, especially in the course when we talked about the four close placements of mindfulness. I had the incredible pleasure of speaking to Lama Zopa Rinpoche today. I think we were on Skype. Rinpoche's in Bodh Gaya. And Rinpoche is saying, what are you teaching? I mentioned about one of the subjects was the four close placements of mindfulness. He said, what is that? I had to tell him the Tibetan name. It's not something he was familiar with. Because generally the Tibetan, they don't spend much time talking about that. So one of the four close placements of mindfulness was the close placement of mindfulness on the feelings. So what are feelings? What is this mental factor, omnipresent mental factor called feeling? It's a particular... You know, it's not the main mind, let's say, in the tactile consciousness. You may feel something that's hot, and let's say right now I brought myself a cup of coffee I made here. Right now it's reached sort of lukewarm. Do you know what that means? Lukewarm, sort of room temperature. I stick my finger in it. I hope I'm not being, you feel that's disgusting. But I don't feel, it's not like pleasant, it's not unpleasant, a kind of neutral feeling. If it were very hot, if it was like boiling hot and I stuck my finger in there, what kind of feeling would I have? An unpleasant feeling, right? That's something we can associate it with. If I am very hot, I just was out in the streets of Singapore walking in the sun, and I were to pour some cool water over my head, although in other circumstances the cool water might be unpleasant, right then I might feel a pleasant feeling in my tactile consciousness. Okay, so generally feelings, this word vedana or vedana, Tibetan sorwa, it's not talking about, I mentioned many times in other courses, but some of you are new here, it's not talking about the general use of the word like, oh, I have emotions, I have feelings for them or something like that. It's not talking about emotions. It's talking about this particular ability of any one consciousness to experience either pleasure, pain, or neutral feeling. Okay, you know what? Example I said here, when you stick your finger in just lukewarm or maybe body temperature water, this is like, it doesn't feel particularly uncomfortable or particularly pleasurable. It's just a neutral feeling. So that's the first one. Second one is called discrimination. I like that. This one, many different translators have, they go all over the place. Different. Sometimes they call it recognition, and what else do you know? Perception. You know, some people call it perception, which I think is, it doesn't make sense to my mind, but for them maybe that. There's something important about language. You have to remember, it's not as though there is a correct way to translate these things, as though the word adheres in the object, so you were wrong if you called it anything else. It depends on your own mind, what works best for you, which of these translations of words evokes a correct mental image of that, you know, so that you understand it. It's just a label, right? So discrimination, we'll go into the exact definition, but it is what, let's say in the, we have the bare perceptual mental consciousness, visual consciousness, just sees shapes and colors. Discrimination is the ability of that mental, of that visual consciousness to discern or discriminate the shapes, the edges, the difference in color. That is done by discrimination in the bare perceptions. How about in the mental consciousness? Mental consciousness, it also has a conceptual function to discriminate. For instance, we can discriminate right from wrong, or you know, what is virtuous and non-virtuous behavior. So discrimination is quite extensive. Sometimes it just appears in the sense consciousness, as it just has this very basic primal ability to add something to the bare perceptual field. You know, say almost the eye consciousness, if it didn't have, it has to have discrimination to function. But say, for instance, there was not any discrimination, it would just be one field with no difference of, you know, it would just be say, like one blob. Maybe you feel that way when you wake up in the morning. Everything looks the same, you know. The discrimination is what is present in the consciousness, and it's that ability to discriminate within the perceptual field. Does that make sense? Then third one is what is called, it's what I was calling before. I was calling that when I was saying citta and cetana. Actually, cetana is intention, is what in Tibetan we say sempa. So what is intention? And again, this is translated variously. Do you know? I can't remember. I think Herbert Gunther. Have any of you ever read any of his books? Herbert Gunther. He was a German psychologist, translator of Tibetan texts maybe 40, 50 years ago. I think he's passed away. But he was, especially Dzogchen and some Nyingma texts and things, he was very famous. I think he translated this, and his terminology, other people, just drove people crazy. He translated this one as something like egocentric demanding. Right? That made no sense to me. Just an intention. So what intention means, and this is very broad also, it has different significance in the sense consciousnesses, the five sense consciousnesses, and the mental consciousness. So intention is that part of the consciousness, you know, it's part of the substance of any consciousness, let's say I consciousness, it's that which moves the primary consciousness to a particular object. Like you may be with your eye consciousness, the bare primary consciousness, seeing the perceptual field, maybe discriminates the shapes and colors and so forth. The intention is that which moves your primary consciousness to one particular part of the visual field in the case of eye consciousness. Intention. But by that word, what do we usually mean by intention? And we talk just colloquially. You know, I intend to go to the store today. Or do you intend to go to the store? Can you pick up some milk for me? Intention usually has the implication of having some forethought, you know, some planning. So in the mental consciousness, it has both it moves the mental consciousness from one object to another. And it has the added function of being that which creates karma. You know what karma is, right? Do you know what karma is? Yes? This man, I forget. What's your name? He never knows I'm talking to him. Yeah. What's your name? What's his name? What? Mr. Torrey. So do you know what karma is? You know karma, right? Action. So sometimes we think action are gross things like chopping off the head of the fish, killing, or giving charity. You know, you see the movement, you think that's action. But all of our physical and verbal actions are motivated by our mind. And the physical and verbal actions are subsidiary. They're still called karma, but the fundamental of karma is this mental factor called intention, because it's moving the mind from one thing to another, placing the mind on something. Does it create karma? Who said yes? You say yes, okay. In a sense, it creates karma, but karma is either virtuous or non-virtuous or neutral, right? That's the neutral here, not the same neutral feeling, but virtuous, or neutral. So is intention itself virtuous? Can be virtuous intention, non-virtuous intention? I learned this in Italy, this mudra. Have you ever seen that before? It means no. It's like shaking your head no. I don't know, maybe the Italians are they're tired. They don't like to expend more energy than they need to, so they just, instead of going like this, they just... No. So how can intention create negative karma? So it would be interesting because the I consciousness doesn't create negative karma or positive karma. Do you know why? What has to be present to make? In a sense, there has to be an affliction present. And not just any affliction, there has to be a... like anger or attachment or something like that has to be present in the mental consciousness. And it's as though the intention is like rubbing a cloth across the floor, which itself would be neutral, doesn't leave any scratches in the wood. But if you were to put some abrasive underneath that cloth, like sand or pieces of metal filings or something, and you scrape that, you'd leave big scrapes in the wood, right? So that's kind of like the intention is moving the mind from one object to another, or moving it to the object. And if there is present within that mind a non-virtuous mental factor, maybe that's a good way of saying it, because not all of the afflictions are non-virtuous. Is that right? Oh. Which of the afflictions are non-virtuous? What affliction could be virtuous? Swikim, you know? Or, I forget, what's the gentleman's name right behind the camera there? He likes to hide. What's your name? Adrian. Which of the afflictions could be virtuous? Could any of them be virtuous? Say again? Wait, she'll bring it in.
Correct doubt?
Correct doubt is not an affliction. Remember, afflicted is only called afflicted doubt. So correct doubt leaning in the correct direction is not considered an affliction at all. How about self-grasping? Ignorance, self-grasping, grasping to true existence. Is say for instance when you create a virtuous action, you know, we ordinary people, not Arya beings, when we create virtuous actions, generally we say, what kind of actions do we create? What kind of virtue? Contaminated virtue, right? What is it contaminated by? Grasping at true existence. So the ignorance that the ignorance that which is an affliction is present, that affliction that grasps to a self of persons or to a self of phenomena is present even in virtuous actions, our contaminated virtue. When is it not present? Well, for ordinary beings, it's always not omnipresent, but it's present most of the time. It's not like one of the omnipresent mental factors. The only time it's not present is when you have a... I'm not sure how deep... When you have a perception of emptiness. Maybe it's... You know, if you have a direct perception of emptiness, ego grasping is not present at all at that time. It's not abandoned necessarily, but it's not present in that direct perception of emptiness. Even before that, when you have an inferential understanding of emptiness, during that inferential realization of emptiness, you're realizing emptiness, but it's not as though the self-grasping is not going to be present at all. Some is subdued very much. And when you rise from that, it pops up again, pops its ugly head up again, right? So not all of the afflictions are non-virtuous. That's why I said, like, with intention, the mental factor, the omnipresent mental factor of intention, kind of like rubbing a cloth across your nice table. the floor you're not so concerned about, but your nice table you just bought, your coffee table, and someone puts some metal filings on it and some sand, and then they say, "Oh, let me clean that off for you." They're rubbing. When I was at Tushita Delhi many, many years ago, before it moved to its present place in India, we have a center called the Tushita, of course, in Dharamsala, but there's a Tushita center in Delhi. So I was there alone in this one place called Sheikh Sarai. Anyone here have been? You wouldn't have. I should have remembered that on the elevator yesterday. We met some Indian people flower garden, and they said, "Where did you live?" And I couldn't remember. Now it just came to me, the neighborhood Sheikh Sarai. Anyway, I had this nice set of copper bowls that I used for water offerings, and we had hired a young Tibetan boy to be the cook. I think he had run away from home. He needed some job. He was probably 15. He was pretty frisky. And he took my, he thought he was doing well. He was cleaning my copper bowls. And you know how the Tibetans often clean? With the ash that's left over from a fire. And that has some kind of chemicals in it, but the fact that it has a little bit of abrasive, just like the powder that you'll use to clean things, it won't scratch your dishes or it won't scratch the pan. It's just the right abrasiveness. But he had taken, I think he went outside and took dirt, and he would cleanse them, and he brought them back, and it had all these scratches in them. So that's kind of an example of, you know, the intention. His hand was moving around, or the cloth he was using, and then what was underneath it, what it was moving, was something that was, the analogy here would be non-virtue. So it was leaving some unwanted deformation there. Okay, how about if intention moves a virtuous mental factor? Remember, there are 11 virtuous mental factors. What happens then? You create virtuous karma. If you happen to have a mental factor, if you don't have a virtuous mental factor, no, none of the virtuous mental factors are present, none of the non-virtuous mental factors are present. Is that possible? Yeah. You still just have ego grasping, you're just sitting there, neutral state of mind, and you look from one thing to another. You create neutral karma, not virtuous, not non-virtuous. Do you know the term that was used in the scriptures? The Buddha didn't call it neutral karma. He called it what? Unpredicted or unprophesized. That is, the Buddha said this kind of action will lead to negative results. These kind of actions will lead to these kind of results. Those things that he didn't make a prophecy about or predict what would happen are called... It's called unpredicted karma. It doesn't mean that it might be good, it might be bad. It doesn't mean that. It essentially means neutral. Okay, so we have, of the omnipresent mental factors, feeling, discrimination, intention, then one called contact. Contact. So this is a little bit tricky, because it sounds like the word contact sounds like it's, you know, coming in contact with something. What this means is a particular mental factor that activates the sense faculty to be able to experience feelings and so forth. It itself could be called a pleasant contact or an unpleasant contact, depending on what object of the perceptual field that it experiences. But its main function is not to experience the feeling, Yeah, we'll talk more about that later. And then the last one, the last of these five omnipresent mental factors, the earlier one was called intention. This one could be called attention. Jeffrey translates it as mental engagement. Hila Chepa. So what this does is it keeps your attention on an object. Okay, so we're going to talk about these in detail. But before I start about that, let me see if you have any questions. Because we're getting near the end. How are we doing? Completely confused? Completely confused? No? Not completely. Partially? Some question? Yes. She's right behind you.
Primary consciousness, you mentioned, Venerable, is not separable from mental factors. So,
that's right.
When the mental factors change, primary consciousness also necessarily changes. Is that correct?
It changes in the sense that it's accompanying mental factors change, but the function of the primary consciousness remains the same. It's still perceiving the bare perceptual data of its perceptual field, you know, whether it be shapes and colors or sounds or smells or tastes or objects of touch.
Is it perceiving, is the primary consciousness then perceiving the cumulative net of what it gets from the mental factors?
I don't think so.
How can there be a dissonance?
Like, what do you mean? How can there be dissonance? That sounds like a question, but I don't know.
Yeah.
What I mean. I don't know what that means.
So if the mental factors, say, resonate a tune, the primary consciousness necessarily has to be the net result of all that.
Well, let me say this. Say, for instance, in the mental consciousness, can the sense consciousness be virtuous or non-virtuous? It would have to have an intention that moved a virtuous or non-virtuous mental factor, and there's no non-virtuous or virtuous mental factors in the sense consciousnesses generally. Some debate about that, but generally we say it like that. So in the mental consciousness, let's say, there are these virtuous and non-virtuous mental factors. In fact, that's the only place generally that we find them, right, in the mental consciousness, when we're thinking. So the primary mental consciousness, even though the intention is moving, let's say, a delusion, an affliction is present, non-virtuous mental factor, and the intention is moving that, so we're creating some negative karma. We say that's non-virtuous. The consciousness, the primary consciousness, is also, because it bears similarities with the mental factors, it would be said to be non-virtuous. Even though the primary mental consciousness itself isn't creating the karma, because it's present while that karma is within it, is being created, we say that mental consciousness is non-virtuous. The primary mental consciousness is non-virtuous. So maybe that can give you another way to think about your question. So let's say like this. I'm not sure this is exactly right, but I'm thinking maybe it might be. Say, for instance, when your consciousness, your eye consciousness sees a person. If I see Mabel, If my eye consciousness sees Mabel, although we see shape and color, the mental consciousness perceives Mabel. So the mental consciousness is knowing Mabel, okay? Can I say that I, George, see Mabel? Yeah. There's a wrong way of doing that when you identify some kind of self, like George, who is different than the body and mind, you know, some self-supporting, substantially existent person, somehow back there, the experiencer of the senses, the owner of the senses. Because that I doesn't exist at all, that's an illusion, but we have that impression sometimes. I saw, you know, President Trump, maybe with pride or maybe disgust, I don't know, it depends on what political persuasion you are. You know. But the merely labeled George who is conventionally existent, the George that is said to be correct understanding, conventionally existent meaning merely designated to the body and mind, George. We can say George, or if in my case I would talk about myself, I saw Mabel without identifying with a substantially existent or truly existent I. So that is this further subject. The consciousness, the mental consciousness is actually what is, I would say the visual consciousness is seeing the shape and form. The mental consciousness is understanding that is Mabel. So that's what is knowing Mabel. But I can say that beyond that, because the I is imputed onto the five aggregates, one of which is consciousness, I can say I saw Mabel. Okay? So I'm using that as an analogy that the primary consciousness could be said to have discriminated the perceptual field, to have felt, you know, some feeling within its domain. But generally, we don't say that. You might be able to use an analogy like that in the same sense that the person is a subject that also experiences. We do say an Arya being realizes emptiness. Does that make sense grammatically? The Arya being realizes emptiness. But what is realizing emptiness? It's the mental consciousness, right? But because the person is imputed upon the five aggregates, one of which is the consciousness, including the mental consciousness, we can say that the person experiences or realizes emptiness, even though there's not a separate person. It's just designated on that. So you have to be careful if you use that analogy, because we might think that there is a separate observer, a person who's observing the consciousness, you know, that's realizing emptiness. Okay, interesting. Okay. Sui Kim, you have a question? Yeah. Okay, something has come up.
Can you please explain again the omnipresent similarities? Oh, no, they share five similarities. So you went through three of them. What are the other two?
I went through five.
Yeah.
I went through five.
Okay, one is objects. They share the same object of... and then same duration.
They have the same base. That means the same sense faculty.
Okay.
You don't have your eye consciousness feeling, which there's a feeling in the eye consciousness, although very subtle, is not going to be a feeling in the ear sense base or the nose sense base, nose faculty. It's going to be within the eye faculty. Okay, so same base, then the same object of observation, the same aspect of that object.
What do you mean by aspect?
Remember I said, like, say, for instance, you see a person, or you know person, and then you're centering on some aspect of that person, being male or female or tall or short or something like that. So, for instance, when we talk about the difference between there's a Tibetan word, mikpa and nampa. Mikpa means the object of observation. Nampa means the aspect in which you're understanding that. You may recognize an object, and the way that you're understanding that object might be as you might be thinking, oh, that's something I need, or you might be thinking that that's bad or good. Those would be the aspect in which you're realizing that object. This differentiation comes up in, excuse me, in talking about emptiness. Say, for instance, well, I'll have to think. I'll answer that later. I have to think, refine my understanding so I can answer that question. But we talk about the same sense base, the same object of observation, the same aspect, the same duration of time, and the same substance, same substantial entity. So that is to say, there's only one, just as there is only one substantial entity of ear consciousness, there's only one substantial entity of feeling of ear consciousness. Okay, and I had mentioned that list where there's difference between object and aspect, those two, when a Sangha made the list, he put those two as one, not differentiating between object and aspect, and he added sameness of realm or level. Say, for instance, if you have a consciousness of the form realm, you can't be experiencing feelings of the desire realm, gross feelings in that consciousness. Okay.
When you experience true existence.
No, it's not possible to experience true existence because true existence doesn't exist.
Okay, when you look at something and it appears truly to you, does it appear to your sense consciousness or your mental consciousness?
What do you think? Who said mental? Oh, you're being courageous today. So it doesn't appear to your sense consciousness as truly existent, you don't think? No, forcing you to say one way or the other. So it doesn't appear to your sense consciousness as truly existent. So you are like a Svatantrika Majamaka. Because they say that perception of true existence is something that's created by the mind. But the highest philosophical school says phenomena appear to our senses because of habituation since beginningless time as being truly existent. That appearance of true existence is one of the main objects that are abandoned by what? Where are they abandoned? That kind of thing. Those are called this is one of the categories of obstructions to omniscience, the appearance of true existence. So those who would be abandoned by the bodhisattva, the Hinayana arhats never abandon them. Even when they become arhats, phenomena still appear to their senses as truly existent, but they know they are not. Same way that bodhisattvas at earlier levels, when they rise from the meditation on emptiness, phenomena still appear to be truly existent, but they know that they're not. On the 8th, 9th, and 10th bhumis, the bodhisattvas begin to eradicate the obstructions to omniscience, but still, until the very last moment of the 10th bhumi, if they were to rise from that, conventional phenomena still appear to be truly existent. It's only when they become an omniscient Buddha, that phenomena no longer appear to the senses as truly existent. So, but the Svatantrika Majjhimakas believe that things don't appear to be truly existent. It's the mind that conceives them to be that way. So I think that's why I'm going to call you now. If I can't remember, I'm going to call you Svatantrika. Yes. Yeah. Yes, question. Oh, good. I'm glad there's some question.
Can I ask you about the question on intention? Earlier you said that when there is for karma to be created, there must be affliction that comes together with the intention.
No. Karma can be positive or negative. For negative karma to be created.
Yeah, I'm talking about negative karma.
Yeah.
So for negative karma to be created with the intention, there must be this affliction that arises, right?
Yeah.
So my question is, how do we who determine or what determine or how can this be prevented? Or rather, do we have control over it?
So how can we prevent this creation of negative karma? By watching our mind, and when we notice afflictions, of course they kind of sneak up on us, you know, we don't notice them right away. That's why we need very close attention to our mind. When we start to notice the afflictions, before we have a chance to act on those afflictions, blurt out some word or start thinking in very negative ways, even the mental consciousness, I mean, the mental consciousness is what creates karma. The physical manifestations of that, striking out or verbally saying bad words or lying, say out of deceit, some desire to hide your faults or to deceive people, that also, those are motivated by the mental consciousness. So the way that we would prevent that is by preventing the afflictions from being present. How can we do that? We have to apply the antidotes. So to apply the antidotes, well, several things that are necessary. First, you have to recognize the fault of the affliction. For us right now, we don't feel so viscerally, so imminently the faults of the affliction, especially attachment. We follow attachment because we think it's something that's bringing us pleasure. Even we don't even recognize sometimes the defects, the faults of anger, you know, other kinds of violent states of mind, because we feel we had to get it off our chest. You know, let get rid of that energy. It's pent up inside. And the only way that we think that we can get rid of it is to just let it all come out at once. We see no other alternative. Buddhist alternative is that with wisdom, like say, that you know, there's a kid's toy called the Jack in the Box. I don't know what it's called here in Singapore. A little crank. There's a little box. There's a lid on the top. And there's a spring inside with a little clown head or something, hopefully not something scary, and the kid turns the wheel, and a certain time it opens up and pops out. So it's like that. We feel like if we don't get rid of our energy, it's gonna come out sometime, and we feel some almost pleasure. We don't see the defect of that. So the Buddhism understands that there is a way. It's not just you have to either repress the anger or let it out. That's often what we think of the alternatives, and we get fed up with holding it in, and we blurt it out. So the Buddhist alternative is, with wisdom, to cause that anger to just dissipate by analyzing. This will pass. This is a result of my past karma. The other person is not the main cause for my irritation right now. Even though I was irritated by their words, perhaps, or their action, they broke my favorite mug or something like that, I'm the main cause of that. So in so doing, as you're analyzing like this, applying what are called temporal antidotes, the mind that is, that tension in the mind that's somehow feeling anger is beginning to loosen up a little bit. If you can understand emptiness, you know, that there is no I who has been you know, how to say, offended, or, you know, there's no I existing that the way that my mind is perceiving. There is no action that is just imputed. This takes higher knowledge, the understanding of emptiness. But just to realize impermanence and karma. If I hadn't created the karma, there was no way that this could happen now. In so doing, it's like a cloud in the sky in the summer. It's not as though there's only two alternatives. Either the cloud, the rain cloud, either has to send down its rain, it's like getting angry, let's say, or has to just condense there and get blacker and blacker. If the sunlight shines on that cloud, it can cause the moisture to evaporate and the cloud to disappear. So the sort of like the sun of wisdom can cause our afflictions, and not just the wisdom of emptiness, but these other wisdom of impermanence, of karma, and so forth. We can cause the, that cloud of anger or other affliction to disappear. Same thing with attachment. If you notice attachment present, and you recognize its faults, you then would apply the antidotes. So there's a sequence that you have. First, you have to recognize that it's there. That's why this kind of study, to recognize the defining characteristics of the delusions and the positive states of mind, very, very important. You might not have thought they were bad before, jealousy or anger or so. So you recognize, oh, that's an affliction, and you meditate on the faults of that, so you feel some discomfort. Then you'll be impelled to apply the antidote to that. So then, if the mind moves to the object, either the affliction is much reduced or maybe, you know, not present any longer. So that's very, very important. And that's a fundamental thing people don't think about so much. That's in everyday life, to apply the antidotes to the delusions. Example I gave sometime is if you were called up into the Singaporean army, can you be called up or you join? Is it voluntary or you have to? You have to call. So if you call up and you're going to basic training, do you have army fatigues on back there? Are you in the army? Okay. So say for instance,
Army fatigue or what was it? Sorry.
So no, I was just asking. I thought you were wearing army fatigue.
Yes.
So you're a good example. So if you're called into basic training to learn how to shoot the artillery or to rifles or whatever, yes. And at that time, if you would be like me, you know, distracted, you've got your iPad and you're watching videos or. And you never learn how to use the thing, then if the enemy is coming, if there's actual battle at that time, and I'm saying to you, well, let's shoot the enemy, and you say, well, where's the manual? You know, the enemy is right there. It's not the time to practice. You know, you need to have basic training. So you need to practice in the laboratory of your mind now in meditation. This is when you apply. So you consciously bring up something which is irritating, something you remember. Someone said bad words to you or something you bring to mind within control, something very attractive that you are obsessed with. Maybe obsessed is too strong a word, but sometimes we have some kind of obsession with something, a person or a job or a title or money that we lost or money we could get, whatever. Bring that to mind that usually causes the mind for the delusion to rise, attachment, anger, pride, jealousy, whatever. So jealousy is one of the secondary mental delusions. It's not one of the root delusions. That's why I said jealousy. So then you have to, at that point, apply the antidotes to causing that affliction to be reduced. Generally, there are two kinds of antidotes. The temporal antidotes, such as impermanence and karma and, you know, so forth and so on. And then there are the No, no, let's say also, let's say for instance, for attachment, one of the temporal antidotes is to analyze the thing that you're attached to into parts. Like, say, if it's a male body you're attached to or a female body, imagine, you know, the skin being taken off. Would you still be attracted to that body? Is it just some superficial conception you have that you're obsessed with? Like in Shantideva's Bodhisattva Charyavatara, this is one of the that he mentions there in the chapter on concentration, how to eliminate these, because these kinds of obsessions and strong reactions to things are the main obstacles to developing single-pointed concentration. So you need to recognize the affliction. You have to realize, to have a strong feeling about the defect of that so that you're impelled to apply the antidotes, and you have to know the antidotes. And then you have to, then you apply them. Then, however the mind moves, as there's no grit underneath, so to speak, there's no affliction there, you won't be creating negative karma. Okay? So we'll talk more about that when we talk about the afflictions, because that's something I want to go into detail. Various temporal antidotes. So the temporal antidotes and the ultimate antidote, universal antidote. The temporal antidotes are specific to particular delusions. There's something that works for that delusion. They don't cause it to be eliminated from your mind. They can't cease it forever. But while that antidote is present in your mind, you're still remembering it. The affliction goes way down. Because we have the afflictions anyway. They might be presently unmanifest, but just about to come, just, you know, depending. So we'll talk more about that. The ultimate antidote is the wisdom of emptiness. That gets rid of everything from the root. Okay? So let's end there. We've gone over a couple of minutes over, so I know some of you have to get back. Let's dedicate the energy, the virtuous karma, okay? Our intention this evening moves the cloth of our mind with some virtuous states of mind. We created some virtuous karma tonight. In whatever way this ripens in the future, may it become the cause of my continued spiritual practice up to and including enlightenment for the sake of being able to help perfectly all living beings, all sentient beings. Thank you very much.